from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. During his time in hiding, author Salman Rushdie's security detail asked that he provide an alias. He chose Joseph Anton in honor of literary heroes Conrad and Chekhov, and that name also serves as the title of Rushdie's new memoir. The Booker Prize-winning author recounts the 9 years he lived under the Ayatollah Khomeini's fatwa, imposed in response to Rushdie's 1988 novel, The Satanic Verses. He joins us for the hour up ahead. After this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this Forum Hour. During his time in hiding, author Salman Rushdie's security detail asked that he provide an alias, and he chose Joseph Anton in honor of literary heroes Joseph Conrad and Anton Chekhov. The name also serves as the title of his new memoir. The author of 11 novels, most of which we have featured on Forum, as well as a collection of short stories and 3 works of nonfiction, Salman Rushdie is one of the world's most celebrated contemporary literary figures and perhaps the most famous, largely due to his having been the recipient of the Booker Prize, as well as the Booker of Bookers for Midnight's Children, now being made into a film scheduled for spring release, but also for the fatwa, or death sentence, put on him in 1988 by Iranian religious leader Ayatollah Khomeini for his novel The Satanic Verses. This provoked a worldwide furor and led to protests, book burnings, and violence, including the attacks against translators and bookstores. In fact, one of the translators was actually killed, and Rushdie spent 9 years in hiding and, in effect, lost the decade of his 40s. He's now written about those years on the run in a memoir, and the name he lived in secret is on that memoir, Joseph Anton, derived from, again, those two writers. He joins us in studio for this Forum Hour, and so good to have you back on Forum. Welcome.
It's always great to be here.
Well, you know, I was thinking that that word that we literary folks used to use a lot, deconstructing. You know, and this morning, President Obama spoke at the General Assembly of the United Nations, and he spoke to the Islamic world, really, I think, in part saying, we must respect freedom. We must respect freedom of speech, particularly. When you deconstruct a lot of you went through, that's really the lesson that has to come through.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It is actually, in the end, a very simple lesson. It's not complicated, you know, that we are very lucky in this part of the world to have this right, that we don't have it by good fortune. We have it because it was fought for and won. And most of the world doesn't have it. And would like, every time it's asked, it wants it. You know, I think if you think about how courageously dissidents in China demand it and are then sent away for years for having just dared to ask for free speech, sent to jail for it. There's lots of Africa in which it doesn't exist as a liberty. Even in where I come from in India, there's a kind of shutting down of liberties that people used to have earlier in the history of independent India. And here we are, sitting in one of the bits of the world where we actually do have it, you know, and it just becomes very important to value it, I think, and to make sure we don't lose it or have it eroded.
Well, what about this argument that one hears that you certainly were faced with when you had to go into hiding, that one should have respect for religious beliefs and perhaps realize that people are volatile and you can be incendiary by talking about their beliefs and insulting them or slurring or something?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm sorry, but I think it's getting things upside down. You know, if people are going to be able to bully us because they threaten violence, that's not an acceptable state of affairs, you know. I mean, this is a lesson that we learn in the school playground. If you surrender to bullying, there will be more bullying. There will not be less. If you give in to somebody who threatens you with violence, he will threaten you with violence more frequently, not less frequently. And, you know, we know this as children. We shouldn't forget it as grown-ups. And I'm sort of tired of religion demanding special privileges. You know, it's one thing to say you have to treat ideas with respect, which you may or may not have to. I think you can be actually as irreverent about religion as you like. You know, and in most religions, have fun poked at them quite frequently and know how to take it. You know, and I was very struck by it. I've been to see Book of Mormon a couple of times and thought it was very funny. And I know that lots of the Mormon leadership went to see it and they thought it was very funny. You know, and that's a grown-up response.
We don't think that Romney has seen it yet, but we're waiting for his response to
I'm not sure how Romney's sense of humor is, but we'll see.
Well, your sense of humor is alive and well in this book, although what you went through was grueling. It was a horror, really, and it is a kind of horror story, almost gothic in many ways. I was struck just with the beginning of this horror, just a phone call, and a phone call from a BBC journalist. Take us back there.
Yeah, I mean, this was, well, the book had, remember, the book had come out in England 6 months before the fatwa. The book came out in England in September 88. It didn't, in America it was different because here it came out after the fatwa. So it came out here in the middle of the storm. But in England it had been there for 6 months before the storm. And yes, there had been an argument about it. There had been various Islamic figures, you know, saying how much they disliked it. And I had actually been doing a certain amount of the argument myself. I'd been going on radio programs, television programs, writing articles, you know, speaking up for my point of view against people who disapproved. And that all seemed to me to be fine. I mean, I think one of the things that books can valuably do is to start interesting arguments. And that was all going on.
Forgive me, was it before that when you talked to, it was how long before that was it when you showed the book to Edward Said and he said, I think the mullahs are not going to be happy?
Well, that was before it came out. And I mean, Edward and I did talk about it. And yeah, I mean, you know, but we also said they hadn't liked any of my other books either, you know, so it didn't seem to be a reason for not doing it. We just, I mean, I knew that conservative religious figures wouldn't like it. And they didn't. And as I say, we were having this argument, but it didn't occur to me that anybody was in physical danger. You know, it was a debate. And then on the 14th of February, Valentine's Day, you know, 1989, I was home working in the morning, and I got called by a woman journalist from the BBC who said, sort of indelible question in my mind, said, how does it feel to know that you've been condemned to death by the Ayatollah Khomeini? Yeah. And I thought, that's one hell of a question.
And your response, I think, was, it doesn't feel good.
Doesn't feel good. And then I ran around the house locking things, which was sort of pathetic.
Well, there's the kind of humor, though, that you see, I mean, particularly from this vantage point, this perch, and you can't, you call it a storm, and you use different metaphors. One of the most striking ones is the first bird in Hitchcock's The Birds.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there's this scene in The Birds where there are these children singing a song in a schoolroom, and Hitchcock cuts outside the schoolroom to the playground, and you see a single bird come fluttering down to land on the climbing frame. And then that's just a bird, you know, doesn't mean anything. It's just a bird on a climbing frame. And you cut back in, the children are singing, and when he cuts out next time, there's like 10 birds. And the third time he goes there, there's, you know, the sky is full of birds. And that's one of the things I felt, that this was the beginning of the storm, or something very like the beginning of that.
Or you call it the prologue.
Yeah.
To the main event.
Yes. I mean, I think by the time we get to 9/11, you know, we know what the main event is. And the thing that was originally sort of mysterious, hard to understand, the attack on the Satanic Verses, I think for a lot of people, they didn't know where it came from. They didn't get it because there was no context for it. You know, there was no larger narrative that it fit into. So it was just a random, isolated event from which no larger truth need be deduced, you know. And only retrospectively, I think, when that became all of our story, you know, when after the 9/11 attacks, that was not just my story, it was everyone's story.
Do we need to make a distinction, though, that your story emanated out of Iran, which is a Shiite country, and 9/11 out of a Sunni?
Yeah, so I mean, it's not exactly the same thing, but it's the same phenomenon. It's the growth of violent Islamic extremism, you know, and that story finds itself in many of the countries of the Islamic world now, and that was very near the beginning of it. You know, it was not necessarily the beginning, because I think one of the things you know as a student of history is that nothing, no one thing is ever the beginning. You know, there are this group of things happening, but it was the one that got the most attention, let's say.
We're talking with Salman Rushdie. His new book is Joseph Anton. As imaginative as you can be in your extraordinary with prose styling, I would have never thought approaching this book that you would see yourself as a soccer ball, but there is a moment where you talk about that.
Well, there's a moment where I thought I was being kicked around, you know, to put it simply, and I was being used as a political football, if not a literal soccer ball. And I wondered, there's a point in the book where I wonder whether the soccer ball can take charge of its destiny. You know what I mean? Can it decide?
Could it have consciousness? A soccer ball with consciousness?
Yeah. Can it decide how to be not kicked around anymore?
Well, there is a lot of kicking around. And yet, one of the real inspiring stories is how your friend stood by you and made, as I think you've described it, a ring around you and protected you, and nobody leaked.
Everybody
like Proust said, literature is all gossip, and there are all these gossipers that did not gossip in one bit. Or
no, for extraordinary that for 10 years everybody kept every secret. You know, and that's I mean, especially as you say, that should happen in the literary world, which can't keep a secret to save its life, would be the conventional wisdom. You know, but to save my life, everybody did keep the secret.
And also as a testament to how people are attached to you and the kind of feelings they have for you and admiration. When you look back on it, though, you've said if you had to go through something like this again, and heaven forfend, you wouldn't hide.
No, I think initially we all thought this was just going to be a matter of some days. Nobody, including the police, thought it was going to be a long-term thing. So when they suggested that I did not go home but instead went off to some quiet inn in the countryside and just laid low for a few days, we all assumed that that was just to get out of the way while the politicians and diplomats sorted this out. You know, so I had no sense leaving home that I was never going to go back to that house again until after I'd sold it, you know, many years later. Literally left in the clothes I was standing up in, you know, and never went home again. I didn't know that would happen. And I think in retrospect, had I known that day that it was going to be a long-term thing, I would have said, you know what, I'm going home.
I was remembering the first time you came in the studio under armed guard. And in fact, when we did something on stage, there were armed guards then. And you came to know these people were really salt of the earth people. I mean, they stood by you, and there's a testament in the book to these people.
Yeah, I mean, I really felt that they were extraordinary because this was considered to be the most dangerous protection that Scotland Yard was undertaking. It was considered to be more dangerous than protecting the Prime Minister. You know?
There was a grade level, in fact.
Yeah. Well, this is called level two, but the very few people are at level one. Means there's somebody outside the room shooting at you. Right? So you don't want to be at level one. Level two is as high as it gets, really. And level two is, you know, is the Prime Minister, it's the Queen. You know, it's very few people. But even in that group, this was considered to be the most dangerous protection. And as a result, the powers that be at Scotland Yard told the protection officers, this thing called A-Squad of Special Branch, which is where the protection officers come from, they were told that they would not be ordered to go to protect me. It would be only volunteers. And as a result, everybody who came to look after me was a volunteer. They were doing it not because they had been ordered to, but because they'd chosen to. And that was rather extraordinary, I thought, you know, given that they knew that this was the most dangerous protection. You know, they volunteered for it. And that's a remarkable thing.
Now, with the fatwa officially having been lifted and the freedom that you felt and the lifting of that burden, you've got some foundation that has put a high price on you, and there's video games in Iran, Get Rushdie, and so I mean, it still persists, it still endures.
Well, what I have come to understand the hard way, really, is the difference between reality and rhetoric. You know, and for a very long time, this was a very real threat in which agents of the Iranian government were being dispatched, you know, to carry out these threats. And as you mentioned, there were actual attacks, including fatal ones. Now, at this point, it really is very largely rhetoric. I mean, every so often somebody remembers, oh, yeah, there's that guy who wrote that book.
Well, Ahmadinejad was just asked about you, and he was sort of fuzzy about where you were. He didn't know.
I mean, I thought it was rather sweet that he had, given how much book launch publicity I've been doing in the last week or two, that he appeared to have no idea that I was around. I think he needs better, let's say, intelligence. But at this point, it's really just occasional fist shaking, and it's not really an issue for, you know, serious concern.
Fist shaking. There's been a lot of talk about saber shaking or saber rattling from Netanyahu, and the idea of I'm just interested in how you will view this all now in terms of what Netanyahu talks as the existential existence of Israel and the need to bomb Iran. And,
well, I mean, you know, I support the right of Israel to exist, but I think it would be very rash to bomb Iran. I mean, believe me, I have no love for the regime in Iran, for whatever reason.
I can't imagine what that reason would be.
But I also know, and I also know that it's a regime that is very widely unpopular amongst its own citizens. But the only thing, in my view, that could unite the people of Iran behind the rule of the Ayatollahs would be an attack from outside. And so I can't think of anything that would be more counterproductive than that. And, you know, and more likely to unleash a dreadful attack against Israel, which who wants that, you know? So I think it would be a bad mistake, a bad mistake.
There is, and one of the things I've been most impressed with in this new work of yours, a willingness to show yourself flaws and all. I mean, you call the character Joseph Anton, you use the third person, it allows you to use novelistic techniques, but you talk about, I mean, you've been so idealized and also so demonized that it's almost refreshing, isn't it?
Well, it's exactly for that reason, exactly for that reason. I think there were so many versions of me marching around, you know, in the bad old days.
Regiment of Rushdies.
Yeah, just, you know, some of them awful, some of them wonderful. You know, in some quarters I was literally demonized. You know, I was considered to be a version of the devil. You know? And in other quarters, in my defense, I think I was just excessively idealized. You know, I was turned into this sort of, I didn't feel like an icon. You know, I kept telling people I don't feel iconic. I feel actual. And I didn't feel like a sort of Statue of Liberty. And so I thought writing this book, I want to say this is just, you know, this is not about a dreadful person or a one or a perfect person. It's about a human being put into, as the police said, one hell of a jam, you know. And here he is. He's not perfect. Sometimes he's weak. Sometimes he's strong. Sometimes he does things he wishes he hadn't done. Other times he does things that he's kind of pleased that he did, managed to do. And it's just a human being trying to struggle through an appalling situation as best he can. And I think as a novelist, that's what I would want to write about anybody. I want to give them a kind of three-dimensionality, you know. And I knew that I had to do that with myself. And I knew that, in a way, I had to be toughest on myself writing the book.
Well, you were tough on yourself. Even admitting something I never knew, that you came up with the naughty but nice.
yeah, now you're bringing up.
You were an ad man.
Now you're bringing up the deep shame now. No, it's true. When I was a kid, I worked in advertising. And I mean, actually, when I was writing Midnight's Children, I managed to get a sort of part-time job where I would end up doing it a couple of days a week. And that's what gave me the money to spend the rest of the week writing my novel. And so, yes, I wrote some advertising. I wrote Naughty But Nice. I didn't write it. I mean, that slogan, I think, that phrase has been around probably since the 1940s. But I used it to describe cream cakes.
But you write about what things that bring you shame, brought you shame. You write about infidelities. You write about drinking problem. I mean, all these things are out there.
To be fair to me, the drinking problem was never really there. That was something I was accused of by a wife who was in the process of leaving me. But my father had a very serious drinking problem, and it was a big problem in our family, you know, growing up. And so I had really deep aversion therapy to that. And I think you would very rarely see me. I mean, I don't think you'd ever see me having had too much to drink, because I've had too much experience as a child of seeing the consequences of that. You know, so I think that was an unfair attack by that particular former wife.
But you write about the difficulties of marriage under this time, the deep pain of not being able to see your children. I mean, there's a lot of really raw emotion that comes through. And in spite of all that, I live until I die. Conrad.
Yeah, I mean, I think I remember, you know, you mentioned Edward Said, that Edward was a great Conrad scholar. And when he had his long, you know, whatever it was, 7-year battle against cancer, he used to talk about that that sentence from Conrad's novel, where the sailor who's dying of tuberculosis says, "I must live until I die, mustn't I?" And Edward certainly did. You know, he went on teaching, he went on writing, he went on traveling, he went on, you know, being Edward Said until the very last moment, as did our great mutual friend Christopher Hitchens. You know, and I also found myself taking that phrase as a sort of talisman, as a sort of mantra, and thinking that's what you have to do. Go on being yourself, do your work, be with your friends, be the father of your children.
As much as you can.
As much as you can.
You were also inspired by Dostoevsky's plight as a writer, by Jean Genet's, by the Samizdat in Russia.
I mean, I thought I'm not the first writer to have a hard time, you know. I mean, the history of literature is filled with stories of writers overcoming terrible hardship in order to get great work done, you know. And I was inspired by that. I thought, okay, look what they did. Look what those people did. And so this is now your turn, you know, yes, you are having a hard time, but don't use that as an excuse. You still have to do your work.
Talking with Salman Rushdie, his new book is Joseph Anton, and it's a memoir. He will be actually at Kepler's Books being interviewed by Tobias Wolff later this afternoon around 12:30 down in Palo Alto and at Angelica Hall in San Rafael at 7 p.m. this evening. Presented jointly by Dominican University and Book Passage. He's with us now, and you certainly have an opportunity to speak with him and to weigh in here and join the conversation with any questions or comments you might have. We do welcome your thoughts, and we welcome your calls and emails. Let me tell you how you can do that. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786. Please feel free to join the program. You can also email us. Email address, forum@kqed.org. Or post any questions or comments you might have on our website by going to kqed.org/forum and click on the segment, or go to our Facebook page, and you can also tweet us, and our handle is @KQEDForum. This is a little bit off the wall, Salman, but reading about Pynchon's teeth, you know, because this is for what people were in kind of my literary world, there was a rumor going around that Pynchon was going to come out of hiding, his own hiding, very different from your, because his teeth had been fixed. And you talk about his teeth looking like Bugs Bunny.
Oh, well, I didn't. You know, maybe he's had them fixed since. But, I mean, I've always taken great pride in the fact that I'm one of the few people I know to have actually met Thomas Pynchon. And I think it's really because I'd written a review of his novel, Vineland, when it came out. That was the novel that broke the long silence.
You know? It was all set up north here, in fact.
Yes, exactly. It's all about Northern California. And I wrote a review that he liked, and so he expressed willingness to meet me. And so we had this very, very private dinner at my publisher's house.
Well, Joseph Anton had the private dinner with him.
Yes. And he was actually great fun. And at the end of the evening, I thought, oh, now we're friends. And then he never, ever called me again.
Well, you've made some friends. I mean, this is Joseph Anton made some friends in high places and some very celebrated celebrities and all that. Even getting on stage with Bono, that's quite a moment.
It was. I mean, U2 was...
Bono.
U2 were anxious to do something supportive, so they invited me on stage at 85,000 people. It was bigger than most book readings.
We will return and continue our conversation with Salman Rushdie. Again, his new book is Joseph Anton, a memoir, and feel free to join the program. 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with novelist and essayist, author of many, many books, Salman Rushdie. His newest is a memoir called Joseph Anton, actually author of 11 novels and children's books, short stories, essays, amazing career as an author. He'll be at Angelica Hall in San Rafael this evening, 7 p.m. presented jointly by Dominican University and Book Passage, and actually you can meet him at Kepler's. He'll be there this afternoon at 12:30 being interviewed by Tobias Wolff. Let's go to your phone calls, and we begin with Hamid. Good morning.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. The question I have is whether our culture is a little bit guilty of a glaring contradiction and a bit of hypocrisy. And the point is this. I'm wondering whether we feel and hold free speech up as a cherished value when we're criticizing other cultures and other countries. But we have certain sacred cows that we ourselves do not tolerate any criticism of, any contradiction with unilateral support of Israel, any sort of racism like anti-Semitism, use of the N-word or any of these things, not tolerated at all. So it seems to me ridiculous that we hold free speech up as something that we advocate in the world as a cherished value, countries that we occupy and provoke, and then we have all of these sacred cows that we will not tolerate the same kind of free speech on.
Are those sorts of things generally answered with violence would be my first question, those things that you just enumerated. Is that always a response? I don't think so, but go ahead. Salman Rushdie.
Well, I don't know. It's more of a statement than a question.
Well, he's saying we're hypocritical, basically, because we are quick to condemn the violation of free speech in any country but our own. I think that's what I heard.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, it's quite right to criticize America's imperfections. And one of the many benefits of being in America is that, you know, you're able to say what that gentleman just said. You're able to criticize America's imperfections, which are many. And I myself think that, you know, the First Amendment, after all, does defend hate speech. It does. And so it means that people, groups like the Ku Klux Klan, are able to, in fact, you know, put out their poison without legal recourse. The fact that there's a kind of social squeamishness about using certain kinds of language, well, yeah, that exists, yes. But there actually is a defended right to use whatever kind of language you like, including all the things that the speaker talked about.
Klan certainly uses it, and there's that Topeka, Kansas group that uses the word about gays that's offensive.
Exactly. Exactly. So, I mean, it is one of the ironies and difficulties, I think, of the free speech position, that you're often being asked to defend things that you don't like, you know, because free speech has to be free speech for people you don't like as well as people that you do. And it's at that moment, really, when you begin to discover if you do believe in free speech or not. Now, I mean, I, for instance, think that it was a mistake in various countries in Europe to make Holocaust denial a crime, because I think it glorifies that crime to outlaw it. You know, it's better to have it out in the open where you can demolish the argument. But, you know, right now at the United Nations, you find the president of Iran, who is a well-known Holocaust denier. You know, there he is standing up in the heart of New York speaking.
More of your calls. Let me go to you next. Sandeep, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thank you.
I am calling to let Salman know that I'm one of his biggest fans. I've read his books, but I think that every time he speaks, so he's so witty. And the way he approaches his critics or anybody that has a different viewpoint, I just love listening to him. And I want to know, I love when he visits Padma Lakshmi. I think they just made a wonderful couple. I don't know what happened. I'm sad.
Yeah, well,
you don't want to go there.
I don't want to go there. I mean, you know, Padma and I are perfectly good friends now. Yes, it's true our marriage ended, but we've remained good friends.
And thank you for the call. Christine writes, could you talk about the fallout from the publication of the Satanic Verses in terms of the bombings in bookstores in the UK and the United States? And what is the responsibility of writers to those who have to sell the books? Has this been difficult for you to come to terms with?
Well, the truth is that some of the most principled and heroic defenders of free speech, and indeed of this particular cause, were people working in bookstores, you know, and I think it would be belittling them to say that they don't know what they're doing, because they were some of the most principled people. You know, I always thought in this case and in many other literary attacks that the bookstore is the front line, you know. Bookstores are not places which have huge financial resources. They're not people who can afford colossal security protection or whatever. You know, they're stores. They have to have an open front. You know, people can just walk in. And I know that there were great attacks. You know, there was a Cody's bookstore in Berkeley. We remember that well. I mean, I visited the store and saw the damage. And all over the country. And it wasn't just bombings. It was of day-to-day threats and menaces that people working in stores were receiving. And yet, nobody caved in. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing that one should say and say over and over again. Nobody caved in. You know, if you think about the booksellers in America, in Europe, and elsewhere, there were threats everywhere in the world. There were firebombs in Australia even, you know. And yet, the book trade did not cave in.
This is really extraordinary.
Yeah. And I remember I received any number of letters from people working in bookstores, from people running bookstores, saying that this had happened, that had happened, you know, various threats and menaces. And their response to this was, put the book in the window. Mm-hmm. Get more copies. Put it up the front of the store, you know. And that is heroism. You know, and I think what happened is there was a heroic collective act by the world's book trade to defend the right, their right to sell the books they wanted to write, their customers' right to read the books they wanted to read, because those are rights too. It's not just the writer's right to write. It's also the reader's right to read. And all of this was defended in the first instance by booksellers, and they were determined to do so. So I think their principle, their understanding of the principle is very important and needs to be celebrated.
Well, you do celebrate the heroic actions of booksellers and the heroic actions of those who guarded you. And there are also some people here who, were you trying to settle scores?
Well, I don't, not a lot, really. I mean, I can't say that I'm completely innocent of it, but I did want to, wherever possible, try and see things from both sides, you know, so that even when there were people who were disappointing or who I thought let me down or let the side down, you know, I wanted to see if I could possibly understand the world from their side, you know. And sometimes I don't understand it. I mean, really, when there are one or two writers whose attack, there were very few writers who did get on the wrong side, actually. I mean, there's so
Let's name them. Le Carré and Roald Dahl.
Roald Dahl and John Berger and, you know, one or two others. But there are so few that we remember all their names. I mean, that's how few there were. And in some cases, I mean, John Berger was a real mystery to me because I felt, you know, he's sort of old school Marxist, you know, and what's he doing defending religious extremism? And it really bewildered me. It still does. And, I mean, I knew John Berger. I thought we were on perfectly good terms, you know, so it really shocked me when this attack came. And we have a lot of friends in common. I know a lot of people since then have asked him, they said, what the hell do you think you were doing? And he won't talk about it. He refuses to talk about it. So I'm hoping he's embarrassed.
Well, it was hurtful, though, I'm sure.
Yes.
Kristen writes, in about the year 2000, while I was working as a line cook in a fancy New York City restaurant, my favorite author came in for dinner, Mr. Rushdie and Mr. Robin Williams. You've been friends for a long time, because I remember doing an interview with you on stage. He came backstage after it was over.
Yeah.
Ordered the best, most interesting things on the menu and were kind enough to send a bottle of champagne to the kitchen. He is a great thinker. That's you.
Oh, no, that's maybe Robin.
Maybe Robin, no. And a beautiful storyteller, so I think it's you. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I love the Moore's Last Sigh. That one doesn't get enough adoration. Ramin writes, it's such a delight for us to, again, be able to hear from Salman Rushdie. Here's the thing. Iranians, especially those who live in relative freedom, must try their utmost to undo the damages that this crazy regime in Tehran is doing to our civilization. The mullah thugs who hijacked the aspirations of Iranians more than 30 years ago, the lunatic Khomeini and his current descendants, are not true representatives of Iranian civilization. Their fatwas can never be considered as having any validity or meaning. Beliefs that are built on a house of cards can never be a foundation for true faith. Hopefully, the regime in Iran will soon change, and I hope that Mr. Rushdie's teachings can help bring about a transition there.
Well, one thing, you know, I'd like to say that I actually have been to Iran. When I was very young, I was 21. I just graduated from university, Cambridge, in 1968, and I drove across, with an English friend of mine, I drove across the world from London to India in a mini. But, you know, think about what the world was like then. You could do that. You could drive across Iran. You could drive across Afghanistan. You know, try doing that now.
Well, a couple of kids just went over the border and they were local.
So it means I did actually get, this was, of course, Iran before the Khomeini revolution, but it meant that I was there for about a month, I guess, and I met a lot of people and I went to a lot of places in Iran and I really loved it. I thought it was a fantastically sophisticated, cultured country.
Do you speak any Farsi?
No, I speak Urdu, which has some Farsi words in it. But my Farsi got a bit better while I was there, but it's no good. But I did really enjoy being there. I thought that it was a great, sophisticated world culture. And I've always thought, because of that experience, that of all the people to whom this dreadful tyrannical rule could come, you know, the Iranians were probably the least suited to it because they were so civilized.
You think they read the Satanic Verses? Was it like Samizdat? Did it get in there? Or it,
well, I know that there was I was asked by a group of Iranians, or as they would sometimes call themselves, Persians, living outside Iran, if I would allow them to make a translation, which I did, and that was initially smuggled into the country in hard copy. And now, of course, we have the internet, so I think anybody who really wants to read the Satanic Verses in Farsi can probably find it online.
How did you speak out during the Green Revolution, and what tack did you take?
No, I mean, I can't remember what I said, but I mean, I obviously felt, as we all did, that what this expressed was an enormous discontent with the regime. And the problem is that it's an unusually authoritarian regime that's unusually willing to use extreme force, you know, not unlike what's happening in Syria. So sadly, I hope for better things for the people of Iran, but they're going to have to do it themselves, and it won't be easy.
Are you in favor of overthrowing the Assad regime? Because there's a lot of question marks about who would be in its place if it is overthrown.
Well, I think, you know, by now...
It's a brutal regime, but notwithstanding...
No, who knows what will happen next, but by now I think any shred of legitimacy that regime had is long gone. I think people, anybody who starts murdering his own citizens in these numbers, you know, just no longer has the right to lead the country.
We go to more of your calls. John joins us. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Michael. Good morning, Mr. Rushdie.
Hello.
Welcome to San Francisco.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you here. I'm reading a book right now about a young man who cast a vote in a 2009 Iran election, and he was arrested and tortured. The book is written by Afsana Mokadam. I'm wondering if you're familiar with it.
No, I'm not, I'm afraid. I mean, I have to say that I'm not in any sense an expert on Iran. I don't speak the language, and other than that visit when I was 21, I haven't been there. There's one thing I knew about Iran, which is that for 10 years they were trying to kill me, and that focused my mind. And in those days, I really became more knowledgeable about the ins and outs of the system. But I don't ever want to pose as an expert in the place because it's not one of my areas of expertise.
Of course, under the present Islamic regime, there was a lot of negotiations that had to go on just to have the fatwa lifted.
Mm. And one of the things that really helped in those years that I tried to talk about in the book was the intervention of President Clinton, because the previous U.S. administration had been very uninterested in being being in any way involved in this matter. But Clinton was, and his support stiffened the spine of many other European countries, and gradually, you know, it helped to begin a campaign which, in the end, with the help of the Blair government in England, brought the Iranians to the negotiating table.
A listener named Anamika writes, Mr. Rushdie, what are your perspectives on the heightened Islamophobia in the United States that has made Islam an easy target for vilification and rebuke?
Well, see, I mean, I have a worry. I just worry about this word. I mean, there's two things, I think. You have to separate ideas from people. And clearly, people should be protected and defended, and not just in America, but in Europe. There are these racist vigilante groups that go out and try and attack people because they're perceived to be Muslim, and they actually aren't always even Muslim. You know? And that's clearly...
In this country, they were attacking people with turbans on their heads.
Yeah, exactly. And that's clearly, you know,
Sikhs.
Appalling, yes. But I just do believe that you cannot protect people's ideas. You just can't do it. You know, it's if you hold ideas which I dislike, I must be allowed to say so. You know, if you think the world is flat, I must be able to poke fun at you for saying so. If you believe in a religion which is not mine, I must be able to criticize it. You know, it's otherwise we've lost something very important.
Chris, you've heard the old argument. It's like yelling fire in a crowded theater.
Well, that's a different thing. I mean, that's because that has a consequence which is immediate, which is it creates panic and hysteria. there are the limits to free speech must be proven every time. Let's say the default setting has to be that speech is free. You know? Now, there are attempts to limit, for example, in time of war, there are attempts to limit what newspapers can report. You know, and that certainly was the case for a time during the Iraq War, where the American press was not allowed to publish, for example, photographs of American soldiers returning home in coffins, because it was thought that it would undermine the war effort. And, of course, the U.S. press objected to that very passionately and was right to do so.
Thank heavens it's a free press.
Yeah.
A Facebook comment. Thank you, Mr. Rushdie. This is from Daniel, for being the unfortunate leading edge of the spear for free speech. I cannot understand why there isn't more of an outcry against the practice of harming those who speak out against what others hold sacred. I am constantly offended on a daily basis by many things I see and hear. I live in a diverse society, and I'm happy for it. The price for such variety is offense. I stand offended gladly.
Yeah, I know exactly how he feels.
Another listener writes on our website, what do you think of the extra harassment women writers like Taslima Nasreen face from the religious right?
Well, it's clear that, I don't want to specifically talk about Taslima Nasreen, but I think it's certainly true across the Arab world that women writers have always been in the forefront of the campaign to open those societies, because I think women writers are more keenly aware of the problems of those societies because they're women, you know, and so many of the discriminations of those societies are against women. So there are, I mean, I admire enormously a lot of Arab women writers, Hanan al-Sheikh in Lebanon, you know, Adaf Suef in Egypt, Asia Jabbar, I mean, a whole range of them. And I've often believed that that women writers and women intellectuals will be in the forefront of the change, and therefore, of course, they're sometimes in the forefront of who is getting attacked. This is unfortunately, you know, it's a sad fact that tyrants target intellectuals, you know, that they fear them. And in this case, women intellectuals are speaking about obvious abuses that much of this very male-dominated patriarchal society doesn't want to change. And so they become targets too.
I'm a big admirer of many of the Indian writers, Indian-American writers, Ayandati Roy and Bharati Mukherjee, just to name a couple, and was appalled when you were not given welcome, mainly for political reasons, at the Indian Literary Festival. And it still kind of stings many of the writers from not only here in the United States, but in India, I imagine.
Yes, the weird thing about the Jaipur, this is, you're talking about the Jaipur Festival.
The Jaipur thing,
at the beginning of this year. The weird thing about it is that I'd been to the same literary festival a few years earlier with no difficulty at all. You know, and this was, unfortunately, an electoral ploy. I just happened to be there when there was an election coming up, and some local Congress party officials thought that they would increase their share of the Muslim vote by standing out against me. I was rather satisfied to see that when the election took place, their share of the Muslim vote actually went down. But I mean, actually since then, I mean, 4 weeks after that event, I actually did go to India and I spoke at a conference in Delhi, much bigger. I mean, Delhi, after all, is the capital. You know, it's a much bigger city than Jaipur, with no problem at all. You know, and I have been going to India most years, I mean, every year, in the last more than a decade, without there being a problem. So this was, I mean, I would say it was a blip. It's an unfortunate blip, but it wasn't characteristic of what's been happening when I go to India.
Listener named Bawana writes, for the record, I think a great injustice was done to Mr. Rushdie regarding the threat to his life. However, also for the record and for journalistic integrity, the word fatwa does not mean death sentence. This is a word like jihad, which has been grossly mistranslated, first by academic Orientalists and then by Western media. A fatwa is simply a legal opinion and can be in a variety of realms, from Muslim dietary laws to Islamic economics. Also, you asked Dr. Rushdie.
Professor, actually, if you want to get it right.
Sir Salman. about being careful about religious sensitivities. I think there should be a differentiation between poking fun at a religion, like the Book of Mormon, and intentionally trying to insult people's religious views. While neither ever justifies violence, I think people of conscience should at least work against the latter and not write it off so easily. Is not insulting people and then granting the insulting party immunity a form of bullying as well?
Well, the question is, what do you call an insult? You know, one person's joke is another person's insult. You know, there was a cartoon in the paper last week, which had the Pope and a couple of his cardinals looking at some website of young boys, with the Pope quoted as saying, and then you just have to click on the one you like best. You know, now, what's that? Is that a joke? Is that an insult? Depends who's listening, I guess. But the fact is that we regularly accept that ideas are criticized in this way in the West, you know, that you can take on the subject of pedophilia in the Catholic Church and satirize it. Now, some people might say that was an insult, but I think it's important to be able to do it.
And we go to more of your calls. We go to Ubad. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael. This is Ubad. Just wanted to thank Mr. Rushdie. I'm a huge fan of your work for a very long time.
Thank you.
Like you, I'm from Bombay, and I grew up in a moderately Muslim family. And what I wanted to see was work he gave me opportunity to humanize the prophet in a way I hadn't been exposed to before.
You know, we've got a bad line here, but let me ask you to call back. We're just not even getting the gist of what you're asking. You know, I'm sorry for that, but perhaps we can get you on a better line. In the meantime, let me go to another line. Paul, that's you. Hi, Paul.
Good morning, Michael, and thank you, and Mr. Rushdie. It's a privilege.
Thank you.
Some years ago, I heard a quotation of Muhammad addressing his followers, which I'll paraphrase. He said something like, if after I'm gone, you worship Muhammad, then Muhammad will have failed.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that what a lot of these extremists are doing is idolatry of Muhammad and really dishonors him. And I'm surprised that I've heard no Islamic leaders make any note of this.
Yeah.
And I'd like to hear
I think you're absolutely right. That it's one of the central ideas of Islam that the prophet is not to be worshipped. The reason why he always referred to himself as a messenger, you know, was exactly that. He said that he was just the messenger. The message was what was important. Also, one of the critiques in Islam of Christianity is that Christians made a god out of their prophet. You know, and so, yes, I mean, in correct Islam, there is very much an insistence that the prophet is just a human being through whom the message was conveyed and is not to be turned into an object of worship.
It's almost like what the Chinese did with Mao Zedong. I mean, he said in his red book, do not make me into an object of worship, do not deify me, but they did.
Yeah, one of the reasons why it was, in many countries, though not, interestingly, Iran, considered to be wrong to make images of the prophet is that it was feared that if such images were made, they would be worshipped. You know, and so the prophet of Islam himself, the caller is exactly right. That was his point of view. But the way in which the faith has developed has indeed made him into an object, a person about whom it's, you know, around whom there's a whole range of taboos.
Muhammad was also very open to the idea of women being educated, and yet what we see in Afghanistan among the Taliban and so forth is just something so counter to that.
I mean, I think one of the things I felt is that I did study this period, you know, the early period of Islam, the life of Muhammad and the rise of Islam in quite some detail at university. And I sometimes think that the people claiming to be acting in his name know a lot less about him than they should, you know, and that actually if you were to look at the life of the prophet, it shows a much more open mind, a much more tolerant person than many of the people acting in his name.
Try to get another call on here, and that's you, King. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling from San Mateo, California, but I grew up in Calcutta, India. And Mr. Rushdie, I have to say, I have many dog-eared copies of Midnight Children and Haroon and the Sea of Stories, and I love them, so thank you for writing those.
Thank you.
I just had a bit of an abstract question. I was, thinking about the discussion around free speech and art, and I'm wondering that's usually that's how the conversation gets framed. But I'm wondering in the age of YouTube and other democratized forms of information, if more abstract concepts like literature and literary devices and irony and such things can be brought to the masses, for lack of a better term, and uh, if you know, if you know of any experiments to do the same in places like India and other places in the Middle East where there's a thriving outrage industry, and in India definitely it's all the religions are equal opportunity offenders on that front.
Mm. Well, I think you're right about India, sadly. I think it is it is getting to be easier and easier for religious sectarian groups to attack various kinds of speech, which isn't just literature. It can be movies, it can be painting, it can even be scholarly texts that have been under attack of late. I don't know what the world of the internet can do. I'm not sure that I would turn to YouTube for the study of irony, except unintentionally.
Now there is Salman Rushdie's wonderful sense of humor. I mean, if you read the as painful as parts of this new memoir to read, there are also some very funny bits. It was sort of like 007 at some moments. In fact,
It was one of the things I used to say to my friends that the whole thing that was happening was not funny, but looked at it another way, there was lots of it that was funny.
Well, thank you again so much for being with us. What's next for you?
I don't know, more of this, I think, just running around for a bit. And we've got the movie of Midnight's Children coming out, which I'm immensely looking forward to.
Very exciting. Congratulations on the memoir and the movie. And thank you again for being with us. Salman Rushdie's book is Joseph Anton. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening. I want to thank our senior editor, Dan Zoll, and our producers, Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Amanda Stupai. Our engineer is Howard Gelman, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. And for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I thank you again for listening. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by the Bernard Osher Foundation, supporting higher education and the arts.